Welcome to Not Work, Myth, and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Before we explore this week's story, I have a question for you. What about your stories? Whether it's a book project that wants to be birthed, deep, authentic writing to support your business, or a personal creative project you can't quite name yet, I'm here to support you through the entire writing process, from the initial ideation stage to the crafting of narrative and beyond. If you're ready to write memoir or a chronicle of the spiritual journey or a book that explores healing, nature, and the power of imagination, as well as the toughest truths of today, call on me. I walk beside you as you uncover the story that only you can tell. I'm a confidant who supports you through the challenges, and I'm your champion who will offer the nudges you need to get the words on the page. And yes, we hold space for the mythical and the magical all along the way. Visit my website, marisagowdy.com, to learn more about my writing coaching services and set up a free 30-minute consultation. Season 6, Episode 17, The Theft of the Golden Apple, a story from the Narn Sagas, told by Stephanie Mackay. Our guest, Stephanie Mackay, is the founder of Mythology Club and co-founder and director of the Fianna Wilderness School. She specializes in ancestral knowledge, earth-based skills, ceremony, and myth. Stephanie has a degree in literature, which has been enriched by over 15 years of transformative practice and study. She has delved deep into the realms of myth and initiation through trainings with the Animus Valley Institute, Haven Institute, Wilderness Awareness School, and over a decade of study with Martine Prechtel. Her work is deeply informed by the time she spent in Alberta, collaborating with Blackfoot and Métis elders as part of the Rediscovery Initiative. She has held the role of senior guide and director at nature-based organizations across Western Canada. Stephanie is dedicated to uncovering the vestiges of intact cultural origins within the body of old European mythologies. Drawing from the wellspring of these old mythologies, she seeks to uncover the hidden pathways that lead us to our cultural origins, reviving traditions long forgotten and holding space for the rehydration of ancestral wisdom. You can find more about Stephanie at stephaniemackay.ca. Well, I am so excited to welcome Stephanie to the podcast here today. And as is our way on Knot Work Storytelling, we're first going to ask the story to speak for itself, and then we will sit and explore all the ways that it resonates and matters in our hearts today. So Stephanie, welcome. Fáilte. Will you tell us a story?
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. I would love to share a story. So first, I just want to give us a bit of a journey to where we're going. We're going to the Caucasus Mountains with this story. The Caucasus Mountains are located right in between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. They stretch from one shore to the other shore. And this story lives and breathes and is deeply embedded in the land of the Circassian people in what's now called Georgia and parts of Russia, and comes from the folklore of the Narts. And the Narts are the ancient people of the land, the ancient beings, the ones who are the earth, who live in the earth. And the story goes that the Narts had a golden tree. And this golden tree was special, not just because it was golden, but because each morning, one apple would sprout from this golden tree. And by the evening time, the apple was ripened. And this apple held magical powers within it. One side of the apple was white, and one side of the apple was red. And they say that if a woman ate from the white side of this apple, that she would give birth to a beautiful daughter with hair silken white. But if she ate from the red side of the apple, she would give birth to a handsome boy who also had hair of silken white. Now the Narts had a deep relationship with this tree. They loved this tree. They revered the tree. They received the magic of this tree since time immemorial. But there came a day when one morning they woke up and went to the tree to pick the apple from the tree, and there was no apple there. Now they knew that the apple had sprouted in the morning and had ripened through the night, but the next morning it was gone. So they returned every morning after this, and sure enough, the apple was gone. So they gathered council. They gathered in council, and the Narts came together and they said, we must do something about this. We can't let our apple be stolen from us, be taken. So they decided, well, let's put a guard. Let's put a guard in front of the tree. You know, and this guard will surely capture the thief. So they set out a guard. The guard stood there with sword, with bow and arrow, with shield, with whatever he had. And in the next morning, when the next morning came, the apple was gone and there was no sign of the thief. The Narts gathered in council again and they said, surely we must do something more. So they decided to set up a fence around the whole tree of thorny branches. They thought nobody will be able to pass by this. Next morning comes and the apple is not there. They gather in council again and they say, we must do something more. Let's gather a whole band of warriors. Gather all of our warriors together to circle the tree and guard our sacred apple. They did this. The next morning, alas, the apple was not there. They checked the ground. They could find no tracks. They checked all around. There was no sign of any thief. They were befuddled. And this went on for quite a long time. They were not able to capture the thief. No sign of the thief. But word got to an old Nart named Tedemco. Tedemco is understood to be the grandfather of all Narts, the grandfather of the land, the grandfather of the people. And Tedemco had two sons, and his sons were named Pija and Pisigash. Pija and Pisigash were known to be great warriors. Their arrows never went astray. Their swords never failed to hit the mark. So they agreed to be the ones to go and guard the golden tree. When they arrived, they set themselves up, and as the light dimmed and night came, the older of the two, Pija, he got rather tired. His eyes were heavy and he fell asleep. But Pisigash, the younger, sat ready with his bow and arrow. The night descended and he sat and he sat and he waited. Well, in the moonlight, in the middle of the night, he saw three doves come and alight on the top of the tree. He paused for a moment, just for a split moment of what should I do, he asked himself. But he didn't wait long and he pulled his bow and he shot an arrow and wounded one of the doves, clipped one of the doves on the wing. The doves flew off, and they took with them the sacred apple. Pisigash jumped up. He woke up his brother, and he looked down on the ground, and there were drops of blood from the wounded dove on the ground. From some stroke of grace or intuition or some deep knowing that Pisigash had, he took out his handkerchief, and he daubed up the blood that was on the ground and kept the handkerchief in his pocket. And he said to his brother, "We must follow the doves." So they followed the doves by the track of blood on the ground. And the track of blood led them to the edge of the sea, to what we now call the Sea of Azov. And they stood there on the edge of the land and the sea, where land and sea meet. And Pisigash said to his brother, "We cannot let them get away. We will bring disgrace to our family. You stay here. Stay here, and I will go into the deeps of the water in search of the doves and the sacred apple." And he said, "Wait here for me for a year. Stay on these shores. Wait here for a year. If I don't come back in a year, you will know that I'm dead." With that, he took out his sword and he touched the tip of his sword to the waters, and the waters parted and opened up a path down into the depths of the sea. Pisigash said goodbye to his brother and he followed the path down into the depths, into the deep, dark depths of the sea. And he went for a very long time, all through the dark, until he saw sort of like a hazy mist off in the distance. And he followed towards this hazy mist. and it led him into a ravine. And on the far side of the ravine was a beautiful white house. And he went to this white house and he entered the white house and he was greeted there by seven brothers. Now, these seven brothers were quite curious to him. They all looked the same. They moved the same. They talked the same. They sat together. They stood together. They moved and did everything all as one. But they welcomed him. They had brilliant hospitality. They sat him down, and in came two women. And they were carrying a bowl of water and a white towel. And he washed himself as hospitality goes. And then the two women left, but shortly were to return with a table with three legs laden with all the most beautiful foods. And they brought the foods over to Pisagash and they offered him food. And at first his eyes were in wonder at all of the food that laid before him. But then he realized that there in the center of the table stood the very apple that he was seeking. He cried out, "Ah, it's amazing. My quest has led me exactly to where I am wanting to go." And he marveled, but nothing else was said at this moment. They all just kept eating. And mostly there was silence while they ate. But then finally the brothers said to him, they said, "You have been honest with us, so we will be honest with you." They said, "We are the children of the goddess of the sea. And you have arrived here at our home. There are seven of us brothers and we have three sisters, but you're only seeing two of them here because one of them is not well. One of them is the other room. She is bleeding and she is in need of help." Well, Pisagash heard this and he said, "Is there anything that I can possibly do to help?" And they said, "Here's the story." They said, "Our three sisters have been flying to the land of the Narts in search of husbands. And they've flown back and forth and back and forth so many times. But this time when they returned, our youngest sister, Megazash, she returned with a wound on her wing and she's left bleeding." And again, Pisagash said, "Please tell me if there's anything that I can possibly do to help." And they said, "There's nothing you can do." They said, "The only thing that will heal her is some of the blood from the land that she spilled in the land of Narts brought here." And Pisagash's eyes opened wide and his heart jumped up and he said, "I happen to have that very same blood right here." And he pulled out his handkerchief and he gave it to the brothers. The brothers took the handkerchief and they dipped it in some water and they took it over to their sister and they put it on her wound, and immediately her wound was healed. There was great joy. The brothers' hearts were warm and happy and they gave great honors to Pisagash for healing and making the journey all the way to their home. And they said, "Nobody has ever made it here before. You are one who can travel both on the seafloor and both on the fields of the earth." And they said, "In exchange for healing our sister, we will grant you the gift of marriage to any one of our sisters. Who do you choose?" Well, it didn't take Pisagash long. Of course, he said, "Well, I would love to take the hand in marriage of the woman that I healed." And so, of course, this was granted. Megazash, of course, agreed. She had been in long courtship of this one. And so she agreed, and there was a great banquet, and they feasted and they celebrated. They eventually left and made their way back out through the deeps of the water and up to the shores where the sea meets the land. And there was standing Pija. Pija welcomed his brother back. There was great rejoicing. And they made their way to the village of the Narts. And there they celebrated for 7 days and seven nights the marriage and the return of Pisagash and Megazash. In time, Megazash gave birth to two sons, one named Morzameg and one named Yimis. And they became great leaders of the Narts. But that is a story for another time and a tale for another time. And that brings us to the end of our story.
Oh, Stephanie, thank you for giving us a story here in this time. That really feels like it's speaking from the depths of time.
Thank you.
And it feels like you've just passed us a mystery, a well-described, perfectly enumerated mystery. Because I love how there's the play of the two and the three and the seven. Mm-hmm. And it all feels like, at one level, something I want to be able to decode immediately and understand. Mm-hmm. And also something that perhaps if I could let my brain not have to work so hard, I could simply receive it.
Beautiful. In that receiving, I have a question for you. In the story, as you're allowing it to just live in you in this moment, is there an image from the story that stands out? Where do you place yourself in the story? What image pops out?
I keep seeing it's the sword that pierced the sea and opened up the way.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah. Could I turn that on you and ask for you what's most present for you in this moment?
Oh, what's most present for me in this moment? There's something about the dipping of the handkerchief in the water. And I've told this story for a number of years. And for some reason this time around, I never really noticed that first they dip it in the water and then they place the handkerchief on their sister.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's standing out to me more this time around. I'm sure there's some mystery in it for me in my life, which I love, which is, you know, we just sit with these images and they carry some mystery for our own lives, which I love. But there's also something, I know you work with a lot of Celtic stories, and there's a story, not sure if you're familiar with the story, The Cup of Healing, but there's a story that's called The Cup of Healing, and it comes from the Isle of Skye, I believe. And there's this very same sequence of a wounding of the feminine and the blood, drops of blood, and the masculine gathering these drops of blood. But first the drops of blood have to be mixed with water before the healing can happen. So that's what's standing out to me.
Oh, gorgeous. I don't know that story. And now I'm excited to go follow that one up.
Yeah.
But I feel as if I might have jumped very quickly into saying, this one's mine, what's yours? And I feel as if there was something else you were going to say in response that I want to leave space for. Because is that a question you tend to ask folks after you tell a story, is what image leaps out?
It depends on how I'm holding the story and how I'm bringing it to people. But it does help with that transition time of, because I love to talk about the deeper layers of the story and bring us into the mysteries and the understandings. But it does feel important to sit in that place for a moment of just what is percolating in you? What sits in you? And just to land for a moment in the mystery of your relationship with the story rather than jumping straight into what can we open up, what can we uncover.
It feels like an invitation to be embodied with it, because I mean, I instantly go, like, you know, I'm a daughter of the ocean. You know, I grew up in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. I am a daughter of the sea in so many ways, and that and I'm intrigued with why the very masculine image of the sword in that moment, is it about, you know, doing, creating that human craft, making the magic possible.
I love that. So generally let's just both of us hold those images, and, you know, then we can journey with the story a little bit and then even cycle back around to them if it fits.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because something I know of your work is that, and there's, maybe it's, I could go as strongly as to say there's different schools of thought of how we work with mythologies, right? Mm-hmm. And that sense of knowing that, you know, especially through the work of Jung and others, that sense of really being with the power of the psychology of these stories and knowing that that's taken people very, very far, especially in the last century. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the millennia, you know, that came before it was part of something we would have called psychoanalysis, perhaps, that these stories had revelations that were, I guess, bigger than the archetypes within the human mind. And I think I could say with some level of assurance that you are in that second camp that I just
mentioned. Absolutely. Yes, thank you for that. You know, as you said, I certainly recognize there's a place for the personal, there's a place for the psychology of it. And people have done beautiful work with that. Individuals have been deeply impacted by understanding the psychological lens of a story and integrating that into their own lives. Great work. Mm-hmm. for me, yeah, I tend to go into the other layers, the more mysterious, the more animistic, the more ancient layers of the story, the land-based understandings as best as I can in my humble little way. Holding the knowing that the stories in their place of origins, in their time of origins, and for the majority of their journey through land, time, and in relationship with human culture and soul, the psychological layer did not exist. It's very recent. So yeah, I like to give voice to those parts because I think they're an important voice in this time. And I think that the stories are actually deeply longing for that remembering. And my understanding is that they're fed when we remember those parts of them and give voice to them and celebrate that. And yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what strikes me in that too, is that if there's any part of the modern self that clings to the sense of, but I read the stories in order to understand who I am, maybe there might even be a cling that says, don't take that away from me. Mm-hmm. It also feels so important to recall that the first question you asked after you told the story was, what image landed with you? So it still has a deep intimacy and a way of revealing the contents of the soul that perhaps bypasses that sense of getting immediately into the analysis and the work that I admit I was working too hard, perhaps while listening to, I want to sound like a very, very smart podcaster and I want to make sure that I'm tracking all the, stop, receive.
Oh
that's beautiful. The invitation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, because I think the invitation is to be in relationship. It's really about relationship. Mm-hmm. And of course, we are a part of that relationship. So there is the mystery of what we bring, how we bring ourselves, what layers of our soul journey are bubbling up or current or present to be in relationship and to meet the story. And mm-hmm. can we meet the story from a place of soul?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if, you know, that's part of the journey is to bring our soul to these stories and be in that relationship.
Mm. Well, it strikes me too, as you mentioned, the power of recognizing that handkerchief soaked in blood needed to sort of be activated by water. Is it in some ways that sense of taking the human and nature herself in the form of water and bringing them together alchemically?
Exactly. Yes. Mm. Which does lead to, you know, a part of the story that one understanding is she's of water and he's of land. And the blood is of land. Blood is iron. Blood is of the land. And so it's the coming together of the land and water to create this union between the two to create life, but also to bring the blessing of the healing.
With that trinity of the fact that she was a being of the air, which makes everything all work together, perhaps, too. Right?
Yeah. Which brings in then this other connection between doves or birds and the waters. And we see it in many other places in mythology that she's a daughter of the goddess of the water. It's, you know, it's in the story. She's a water goddess herself, but her form when she comes to land is of the air. She's a bird when she comes to land. Yeah.
And there's just an inherent mystery in that. Like there's not an instant decoding of that one. It's that other than it's interesting then to just play in another old story of like, of course, when else did we see doves over water was just going back to Noah in the flood and that sense of, there's a familiarity in there that we've almost, you know, I forget about that we have those old Christian stories encoded into us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'll admit, I'd never heard of the Narts until you told me about this story. And that had me both feeling maybe sheepish, but much more intrigued to sit with the map and see this mountains between two seas. Like it's such a mythic space. It's like, You'd see it at the beginning of a fantasy novel, this part of the world and the maps and how it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that. And not many people know about the Narts and the Nart sagas. And I was introduced to them via my teacher, Martin Prechtel. And when he first, you know, introduced us to the Nart sagas, he, you know, it's a, there's John Colarusso is the translator of and collector of the stories. And, you know, he's put together two very large books of these sagas. And Martin said, okay, read the entire Nart sagas. And so, you know, as like a good student, I bought the books and I went home and I read, you know, like the first two stories or something and couldn't read anymore. It just wasn't the time for me. And I returned to them, you know, maybe a lot, like 8 years later or something, opened the book and could not stop reading, read back to front, or sorry, front to back. I didn't read them backwards.
You maybe are in magical, some ways Stephanie. I did.
Yeah, front to back. And yeah, couldn't put them down and have just been completely captured by them ever since. They're incredibly beautiful stories. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this story to your podcast was because it does actually carry an ancestral connection to Celtic stories. So this whole area and the Pontic Steppe, which is, you know, right above the Caucasus Mountains, is said to be, by most reckonings in history, academia, etc., that this is the birthplace of Indo-European culture, and that there was migrations, you know, in both directions, and that the Celts are actually deeply related in deep time to this area. So, yeah.
And there's a level of course, and oh, right. We've, you know, we've planted the Celts in these little tiny archipelago, right? In the in North Atlantic and made that, baked in that sort of limestone and salt into the stories.
Totally.
And that reminder of, no, no, that other Europe is part of this story. And that whole Indo, you know, the Indo tradition really coming in.
Yeah.
It helps to anchor and expand in ways that I think is always really important, because, in, you know, with a podcast like Not Work that, you know, very much relies on the Irish tradition, because that's my tradition I feel most at home in. And then you can expand that to say, oh, it's the Celts, because then we can, maybe that sometimes is more accessible for folks. But then saying, and these stories are always connected to the everything. And sometimes we even can draw the map of where those connections started.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we see the connections in the stories as well. Like I said, there's the story of the Cup of Healing, which has this very, very similar, you know, bones of the story. And so it's beautiful to go through time and space and culture and see the connections and origins and beauty of it all.
Yeah. Well, that kind of calls me to kind of ask you what I think is in one way an elemental question, and also the question about above the everything in terms of about your work, not about like the history of the world. Don't worry. You looked a little concerned for a second there. But the, you know, that sense of, and this is a question I grapple with in my own work constantly, and I realize I'm still in search of an answer, and I will keep searching for my whole life. Probably that's what the work is. But that, knowing that you are so rooted into the land upon which you live now, and you have relations with the First Nations people, and that is so much where knowing your heart is, and the sourcing of the tales from a continent away and from centuries and millennia away, and that dance of looking to the oldest of the European stories to inform who you are today, living upon the lands upon where you do. Can we explore that a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah, great question. Yeah, it's definitely, it's an ongoing journey, as you said, a very long, lifelong journey. And we can make great progress in that journey. I think for me, being, I'm on Gabriola Island, the territory of the Sinemuk people. I've worked with Haida elders. I've worked with Blackfoot elders, Métis elders. and find a deep love for land-based culture. And, you know, there was a point in my journey where it was very clear that, well, in order to feel settled in my being, I have to look to my own origins, my own, you know, ancestral origins for this land-based relationship. Mm-hmm. And of course, the stories, they carry that. They carry that, the vestiges of our people who were deeply embedded in the land and whose lives came from the land very directly and intimately. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, to go back even further towards the tales of the Narts and from the Scythians and et cetera. Mm-hmm. For me, that's a part of my journey to understand more, to, you know, because I think we can look at Irish folktales or Scottish folktales. Of course, my last name's Mackay. I have Scottish and Irish and English ancestry. And yet there's mysteries that are there. There's like, I can't grapple with this particular thread that I see in this story, or where does this come from? Or part of my journey is wanting to remember ceremony that is rooted in my ancestry and not just created from my own imagination, you know? And so it's like piecing together. We have all these different analogies that we can use, but we have all these different puzzle pieces, really. Mm. And I'm trying to put some, or threads. I like threads. I like, let's go with knot work. You know, we've got threads, we've got threads, we've got fibers, you know, weaving these all together to create a new cultural tapestry, but one that is based on, you know, threads from our ancestors. So we're still rooted in something. And so to sort of help weave that together, it's been immensely helpful for me to look to the broader Indo-European mythology, mm-hmm. because there are profound connections and there's profound insight and understanding that can happen, because one story may have a little part of the story, and then another story here will have another little part of the story. And if we bring them together, it's like, all of a sudden there's an image there that I can understand.
Oh, I so appreciate that. And it's, you know, in so many ways, my journey is the same, but different in the sense that Irish culture, Irish story found me when I was yearning for something I could not name when I was a teenager, young teenager. Yeah. And growing up, and I'm working to prove this thesis to myself. It's actually a question I'm working with very strongly right now, and recognizing there's a lot of blind spots inherent in this. So I'll say that as a caveat. Yeah. But there's at least a sense that I have that those like yourself who live on the western side of this continent, there is much more of a tribal First Nations influence just because of the history of the way this continent was conquered. And at the same time, I grew up on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, with the Wampanoag people, where it had that first encounter beach is literally called that because that is the place where the native folk met the pilgrims for the very first time, you know, it was 30 miles from where I grew up. And at the same time, and Cape Cod is different. They do still have a more of a present tribe, but here I am in New York. You know, we have some of the Lenape names, and we, you know, there's land acknowledgements, but there's very little representation of the people. And I'm doing more to search out. There's, you know, some more tribal representation in New Jersey, a neighboring state. But so I name this and to say, I ended up going to my ancestral connections first, in a hunger for something. And now it's kind of that calling in to say, and how can I be in right relationship with the sense that I know there are stories on this land. I bring in the Kalyak and Bridget, and I'm bringing these gods over the ocean, who of course would have come with the diaspora anyway. Mm-hmm. But that missing piece sometimes tends to be, and I know it's unique from others who say, oh yeah, I found other traditions that weren't my own first and then had to find my own. Mm-hmm. I'm almost... maybe in the idea of reading things back to front, I'm reading the story back to front in that way. Beautiful. Of now trying to say, oh, what questions haven't I asked about the land upon which I live now?
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Yeah.
And it's uncomfortable too, but it's both.
Generally it's an uncomfortable journey and, mm-hmm. and, but to hold those questions of what questions have I not asked of this land? What questions have I still not asked of my ancestral lands? Mm-hmm. You know, what questions are actually wanting me to receive them, to be heard by me? To live in that is definitely uncomfortable. And mm-hmm. it's very alive. Mm-hmm. It's very alive, yeah. which feels yeah. important to me. And it also, it feeds something beyond ourselves, which is also part of, you know, mm-hmm. why I'm in relationship with these stories is to feed something beyond myself.
Which in so many ways feels like the answer to so many questions we don't know how to ask within modernity, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 I think we need a different container or a different holding in order to be able to ask these questions. It's like I'm thinking now of learning different languages or knowing different languages. There's only certain ways you can express certain things in a particular language. And have to admit, I am not a language person. But I hear from other people who speak lots of languages that they're different in the mm-hmm. different languages that they're in. And so there's only, like they'll say, you can't express it in English. There's just, it doesn't have the way with it. I think it's mm-hmm. similar with stories, that there's a language of stories. There's a holding of stories, and certain mysteries and questions can only be held within these stories. They can't be held within, say, current movie or the current dominant culture of modernity.
Right. Yeah. The latest intellectual property that the IP they're using for the next 12 films.
Exactly.
Not to throw any shade, but it casts its own shadow when you create megalithic entertainment of that variety.
It does. Yeah, it absolutely does. Yeah. Which is not to say that the mysteries of a story cannot show up in these modern stories. It's there's story works in very mysterious and magical ways. Yeah. I've had incredible moments of like deep soul connection and realization through modern day storytelling or sharing through movies, etc. So there's mysteries that transcend all of it, and the old stories hold a particular beauty and quality to them.
Well, I think what's inherent in what you're saying too is that it isn't necessarily whether, you know, old story good, new story bad.
Exactly.
It's also that sense of what we can do to be receptive to story, to, you know, mm-hmm. you and I being the types who have decided to learn the language of story to a degree that most human beings are like, okay, that's great for them. I'm glad they've got those. We'll go listen to your podcast. We'll go to your weekend program, and then we'll go back to our regularly scheduled real life program.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you know that it's available to all of us if we can be receptive in that moment. I mean, because you know, my daughters love a good Marvel movie. There are times when we all hit the couch on a Friday night, I'm like, there's Easter eggs for the fans, but there's also Easter eggs for the myth mom who's kind of like, oh, do you know what they just did there?
Exactly.
And like, I mean, that feels good. And like, it kind of like rubs the underside of your spine in a way that's just like, it's all working somehow. Teach people to be more receptive to story opposed to being consumers of stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's bring it back to the story that walked us in here. It's almost like you don't forget the one who brought you to the dance, right?
Beautiful. Yeah.
Let's dance with her a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And we said at the top, in that sense of wanting to receive rather than decode. And mm-hmm. at the same time, because I have you here with me, there mm-hmm. is that magic I know you have about revealing some of the parts of the story that may not come to us at the surface level, because mm-hmm. you yourself, as a student of story, mm-hmm. can speak these symbols in a way that's just so adept. So mm-hmm. perhaps you could help reveal a couple of the secrets of this story that you might want to come forth right
now. Sure, I would love to. This is where a large part of my deep love for stories comes from, is the immense beauty that they carry. And sometimes we can tend to look at them, we read them. One of the common things with this story is people can feel, rightly so, feel some challenge around, you know, this hero comes and he, you know, wins and he says, well, I'm going to select you and you, we are now married and, you know, we go on. We have that lens because of the dominant culture that we're in. There's so much underneath that, that to me, it feels so important to lift up. And, you know, I've dropped little hints of it so far in our talk and during the story. But yeah, this story is a beautiful story of the marriage between the land and the sea. Mm-hmm. And the understanding is that where the sea and the land meet, that is the birthplace. And it's actually scientifically a birthplace as well. You know, life did come from where the land and the sea met. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, this is holding that since the beginning of time, understanding that the land and the sea have a marriage and that life, all life comes from that marriage. And that this would be the seasonal or cyclical remembering of that story of the marriage of the land and the sea and the life that comes from it. And, you know, when we look at the very beginning of the story, if we just go to the apples, and there's this part at the beginning of the story where it says, well, this is a magic apple. And if a woman in the story, it actually says, if a barren woman eats of the white side or eats of the red side. And there's often a question of like, well, why are these women barren? What does that mean? And so for me, that really sets up that this story is definitely related to an initiatory journey. It's not, or it's an initiation into a different kind of marriage with the land, meaning that the fertility comes from the apple. The fertility comes from the plants. Mm-hmm. And in most traditional cultures, it's understood that as people, we are born from plant or animal. And so that our original ancestor or the original birth was actually from a union between plant and human or animal and human, which is, of course, where the indigenous people of this land and, you know, around the world get such things as totems or, you know, their origin stories of they were descended from the pike or descended from the bear. Or in this story, there's that relationship that fertility comes from the land, mm-hmm. and that is actually a union with the land, and something is birthed from that. And what is birthed from that in this story is a whole peoples. Mm-hmm. This, the whole peoples of the Norse is birthed from that relationship with the land. Mm-hmm. Some other little, you know, tidbits of the story, which are also magnificent and gigantic, are this. Well, I guess I'll just go to, you know, this question of, was this a courtship or was this, you know, did Megazash have agency in this? And so I'll just mm-hmm. highlight the fact, which I did mention, is that she's going in courtship of the whole, she's going in search of a husband. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is her showing up mm-hmm. night after night after night to mm-hmm. essentially find her partner. And then the quest is essentially, it's like, can you find me? Do you have the capacity? And so this is really also, we look at our own relationship with, and my languaging is with the holy. Mm-hmm. Do we actually have the capacity to go the journey? And this is also mm-hmm. how this is an initiatory journey, is mm-hmm. do we have the capacity to witness the holy, witness by grace, witness a mysterious being, and then to make it the long journey. He goes through, you know, into the depths of the sea. He goes into the underworld to meet her. Can we go into the underworld to find essentially our beloved? Mm. Do we have the capacity to get there? And do we have the eyes to see her? Do we have the heart to make it through the whole journey? So they say, well, nobody's ever made it here before. You're the one, mm-hmm. you know? And so for her, it's like, yeah, you're the one, because, mm-hmm. you know, I've been coming in search of you. Right. You're the only one who had the capacity to actually make it and find me. Another layer, which shows, you know, that, again, this is a courtship between the two of them, is that when he shoots his arrow and he clips her wing and he wounds her, it says in the story, it says his arrow never misses its mark. His arrow never goes astray. Mm. So this is the first time that his arrow was not intended to kill, but that his arrow was just intended to wound. So in traditional ancient hunter culture, hunter societies, the understanding is that the arrow is the phallus and the wound is the vulva. Mm. So you are actually in union with the one who you are aiming at, with the one who you wound or the one that you kill. Mm. There's a marriage that happens. There's beautiful old stories of hunters being initiated into hunter society, or a particular, like a goat hunter or a deer hunter, an ibex hunter, a bison hunter, you know, where they actually marry that animal. Mm. And so this is his arrow shooting. This is their first lovemaking. Mm. Yeah. So mythologically, when he shoots his arrow and he wounds her, that's their first lovemaking. Mm-hmm. So they've already, shall we say, consummated their marriage,
right,
from the beginning.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the story, when the brothers say, the seven brothers, when they say, you get to choose, mm-hmm. you know, which one is yours, that's not a like, oh, you just get to choose one of our three sisters. That's a test. That's again, mm-hmm. the test of, mm-hmm. will you select the one whom you actually have dedicated yourself to?
Right. Right. Will you honor the one you came to the dance with?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, what I'm reminded of too, I think it's Martin Shaw who talks a lot about Lascaux consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. And seeing mm-hmm. the world as if, or through the eyes of those original cave paintings, and seeing those as a romance, exactly. in the broadest of senses.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 There's all of our relationship with plants and animals, with, and even with, as in the story, with the land and the sea, it's romance, it's love. Mm-hmm. There's, yeah. you know, early domestication was not power over, or how we sort of understand it now. Early domestication was a love affair between a plant and a human.
Right.
Or an animal and a human.
Right, right. Yeah. How do you coax in the one who's willing from the herd in order to begin mm-hmm. a relationship? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I presume this is so, it's in some ways it's so obvious, but it feels like it must be said because we are standing up against all of modern culture to mm-hmm. say that what this story wants to say is this, it is an absolute refutation of our culture of domination and stewardship, exactly. in that sense of anthropocentric, here we are, I was put upon this planet in order to grow the crops and tend to the flock, and mm-hmm. I will thusly be rewarded with pearly gates, et cetera.
Right. Yeah.
And instead our holy is coming in the most mysterious form of courtship, because of course, these three doves kept coming night after night, refused to be seen by the like whole circle of men who are standing down there, like presumably looking up.
Yeah.
And that they were doing this in the most gorgeous arse backwards way in the world of saying, yeah. I will be on courtship, but not yet. I am here to court you, but on my own terms. I will take this treacherous journey over and over again.
Yeah.
As I see fit.
Exactly.
And then you'll take the journey, and that's when we will come together, because at that point we've become equals.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Yeah. The doves are, you say they're on a treacherous journey every night mm-hmm. to come to the land. And then it's like, yes, can you meet me in this dance? I will make the journey, you make the journey, and where is the place where we meet?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Mm. And also just that little piece that you highlighted is that all the other warriors are there, and I'm, you know, presumably somebody stayed awake and somebody, you know, looked up, into the tree, you know, was watching the apple, and nobody saw. And that's also how she finds the one who is her one, is because he's the only one. He's the only one who had the eyes to see the holy. And so if you don't have the eyes to see, you don't have the capacity yet to hold the beauty of the holy. There's these moments where we have grace and we see, and then there's moments where we have to go on this treacherous journey to see. But at that early point, he's the only one who had the eyes to see.
I'm going to say another thing that feels at once elementary, but also maybe important, in that sense of, as you were describing before, these stories exist to, you know, narrate our relationship to the land, and they are, you know, they are transpersonal, and at the same time, they're so deeply intimate, mm-hmm. is that these stories would have each been received, presumably around the fire, mm-hmm. by individual listeners, each mm-hmm. one of whom would potentially be the warrior shooting the arrow. And that, you know, sometimes we get into this, if we go to our modern stories and we kind of get into this cult of the hero, there mm-hmm. is that one guy alone who can fix it. And I'm not necessarily certain that those stories are designed to valorize each one of us in this sacred sort of way, to put mm-hmm. each one of us in relationship with mm-hmm. the numinous, with all that might be, with our own dove that's going to come flying over the ocean. And I don't know, I don't want to draw too firm a line on, you know, what stories or who they're speaking to and how, but it just feels like an important moment to sort of sit with this sense of, we can only imagine that those who would have received this story wouldn't just have said, oh, Pisagosh is unique to us. He mm-hmm. is, and yet, could we presume that they would take a Pisagosh within themselves? Or maybe I shouldn't speak for the ancients, I can only speak for us now. And just that's hitting me on a level that it maybe doesn't always. So I'm just mm-hmm. really grateful for that.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. I absolutely, yeah, believe that this is a story that lives in all of us, that these stories do live in all of us. And of course, I do hold the understanding that a lot of them are vestiges of an initiation ceremony mm-hmm. that all youth would go through.
Right.
And that it's not, you know, it's so curious how our modern culture has lifted the individual up out and put them on a pedestal and said, that one is the best. Mm-hmm. When actually the origins of the story is, we all walk this path. We all have the capacity to walk mm-hmm. this path and have our union with the holy or with the land or, you know, however we understand it.
Which feels very distinct from, you know, there's only one captain of the football team. Feels right. like perhaps the modern equation, right? And instead, when you live in an initiation culture where everyone goes through mm-hmm. these passages, it's not just the certain ones who get to win the state championship who then goes on to mm-hmm. become some Wolf of Wall Street sort mm-hmm. of idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody. Martine would always say, you know, there's always the question of like, why is it always a king and a queen? Or why? He said, in the other world, everybody's soul is a king or a queen, or everybody's soul is a prince or princess. We are, our soul is royalty in the realm of the soul, not royalty in the sense of like better than others or whatever, but just that we all have that magnificence, to understand it as magnificence. We all have that magnificence in the other world. And we all, and the task is to carry that. There's a great David White poem about carrying what is hidden from the other world into this world and living it out. And so that's what the stories are sharing with us. We have that magnificence in the other world. We have that journey. We have that union with the holy, and we can bring that magnificence back to this world here.
Oh. Well, Stephanie, that is a magnificent place to land our conversation. I am so grateful to you and for everything that's been explored here in this moment, and I think we'll keep rippling forth.
Thank you so much, Marissa.
Thank you. Before we say farewell, is there anything you want to leave our listeners with about places to keep following your work and your brilliance?
Sure. I mean, my website is the best place to get in touch and to follow what I'm doing. It's stephaniemackay.ca. And I will have some online offerings coming up probably after the summer, though. I'm mostly doing in-person offerings in the area at this point. But I definitely also do one-on-one mentoring, which I absolutely love, supporting people on their own initiatory journey, understanding the mythological mysteries that are surfacing in your lives or in our lives. Yeah, so that all can be accessed through my website.
Oh, wonderful. I admit I was on your site earlier today and having some serious West Coast lust to notice that most of your stuff was in person, but I'm excited to know that more will be coming online, yes. Which is, you know, we'd love to sit and circle with you sometime for in the real 3D. But for now, thank goodness for these digital connections.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Marissa. It's been lovely to be here with you and with the story.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for tuning in to Not Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marissagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.